Welcome to the Chicago Camps 2017 Prototypes, Process, and Play Design Leadership Conference podcast, sponsored by Balsamic. With Balsamic mockups, anyone can design great interfaces. And in partnership with Simplecast, publish your podcast the easy way at simplecast.fm. This podcast features Jay Newton Small, co-founder of MemoryWell, and her keynote, Broad Influence, How Women Are Changing the Way America Works, from August 11, 2017.
Ladies and gentlemen, Jay Newton Small.
It's all yours.
Let me just hide my coffee one second. Hi, my name is Jay Newton Small, until last November, I was actually a correspondent with Time magazine for the last decade. And my book grew out of a story that I wrote for Time about the women of the Senate coming together during the government shutdown to restart the negotiations to reopen the government when none of the men would talk to each other. And so I had a lot of interest in writing about the women of the Senate coming out of that piece. It was by far the most mail I'd received for any piece I'd ever written for Time. And that includes two cover stories on Sarah Palin, so that's telling you something. I had people wanted me to write a book about the women of the Senate because it was so interesting that they'd had such a big impact, and it was the first time they'd reached 20%, 20 women out of 100 in the Senate, and they had this enormous impact in that session. You could really feel the difference, and I'd covered Congress for the better part of a dozen years at that point, and you could really feel the difference the women made when they'd reached this sort of 20% tipping point. So instead of writing a book about the women of the Senate, because frankly all of them are writing books of their own and didn't need one from me, I got interested in the idea of critical mass. So critical mass is actually an idea that comes from science. It's the point in which a chain reaction can no longer be stopped. So it's the point at which a nuclear, for example, bomb can no longer, you can't stop it from going boom. But it's been applied to sociology for actually decades. For example, when they integrated schools in the South after the Brown v. Board of Education decision, they mandated a quote-unquote critical mass of 20% minority students in all of those schools. So critical mass, it turns out, there's been a ton of studies about women in critical mass. And the women in the Senate were just one example of what happens when women reach critical mass in any institution, whether it's a legislature like the Senate or a corporate board, a Navy ship, or an appellate court. Women, when they reach this tipping point, they really begin to change the culture of that institution. And indeed, the women of the Senate, for that two-year period, because all Congresses go in two-year periods, and that was the 113th Congress, for that two-year period, women sat atop 11 of the 20 committees, and they actually ended up producing 75% of the legislation that was passed into law that year, those 2 years. So they had this enormous impact, this enormous change. So my book looks at all the places where women had reached this tipping point and why, and all the differences that they're making. And then it looks at all the places where we're really far away. In fact, Russ's favorite chapter involves a good friend, mutual friend of both of ours, Erie Meyer. And that's, she works in the USDS, which is the US Digital Service, and a lot of women self-select out of Silicon Valley and choose actually to work in tech in DC, like Erie, because they like DC better, they like the climate better, and they like the idea of affecting change through systems and, rather than just one company at a time. So the USDS, for example, is 53% women. So my book has lots of chapters about politics because I was obviously in Washington and I know a lot of politicians. So there's a chapter on the women in the Senate, there's a chapter on women in the House. But the most interesting thing to me in researching this book that I found was that there was this huge difference between the public sector and the private sector. So the public sector actually is reaching critical mass in all three branches of the government right now, 20% in Congress, 30% of the administration in terms of upper level civil service and political appointees, that may change with this administration, and 36% of the federal bench are women. 40% of state judges are actually women. The private sector has been stuck for the last decade at about 17% corporate board representation and about 20 to 21% representation in the executive suite workforce. They just can't seem to get beyond those numbers. So I was curious, why was the public sector doing better than the private sector? And so I took a look at this, and it turns out there are five factors. One, the public sector does not pay as well, and so there's less competition for jobs, and unfortunately, that helps women. Two, the unions in the public sector are much stronger. So when women leave to go on maternity leave, for example, at the CIA, which is, by the way, 47% women. Their jobs are much better protected. They're read in, they can keep up with what's going on, and so that they're not falling behind when they choose to come back from maternity leave. Three, women actually have an easier pipeline. And I know that sounds a little weird, but for example, take New Hampshire. It's one of my favorite states in the union, not just because it votes early, but because it is the most representative democracy in America. There are 400 members of the lower house that represent 3 million residents in New Hampshire. So it's a really small leap to go from running for your local school board to running for your state legislature. You represent like literally 100 more people. And so, so a lot of women actually do run for state legislature. It's a part-time job, as that is in 35 other states. And so they can have kids, and as the kids grow older, they can start taking on more responsibilities, chairing committees, running for higher office. And that has led, in the last 5 years alone, for New Hampshire actually having the governor, the lieutenant governor, the attorney general, half the state senate, and the entire congressional delegation being women. But the number one reason why women actually do better in the public sector than they do in the private sector is because they have different bosses. In the private sector, it's almost completely only white, older white men. Sorry, old white men for who are here. But in the public sector, you have to answer to voters. And women vote a lot more than men do. So on average in presidential elections, women vote 10% more than men do. And they actually make up 53% of the voting electorate. So politicians who are running for office have to actually get women to vote for them. They have to show that they are promoting women, that they're you know, appointing them to different offices, and that has really helped bring more women into the government, particularly when you're looking at political appointees. By far, the hardest part of, you know, hardest glass ceiling that women face is actually executive office, and I guess that shouldn't surprise anybody. But there's very different standards that people expect from executive office versus legislative office or running for a board or running for group activities. So when you're running for a legislative office, people see that as a collaborative thing. And women's strengths of consensus building and getting everybody on the same page is viewed as something that's good for that office, right? They're gonna get everybody together, they're gonna find some sort of compromise, some sort of consensus, it'll be great. But those strengths actually hurt them when running for executive office. So when running for executive office, people believe, rightly or wrongly, that you need to have a very strong sense of command and control decision making. So you have to be able to make decisions independently without a lot of counsel and very quickly. And women are perceived as being weaker at this. And so they have to prove themselves in ways that men don't when they run for executive office. In other words, there's a capability test when women run for executive office that they don't face when running for other offices. And it's a very thin line when you're trying to prove yourself capable enough to crossing it over and becoming a bitch. So, and that means you're unlikable, right? Nobody wants to have a beer with you. And you fail that test. So that has led to women not really populating executive offices. So as you know, there's never been a female president, and Hillary Clinton was the first nominee of either major party. Only 17% of our country's mayors are women, and only 6 out of our nation's 50 governors are women. And only less than 5% of the Fortune 1000 CEOs are women. So the same rules apply in the private sector as they do for the public sector. It's very, very hard to break that glass ceiling. And yet it's never been more important, because having executive women actually supercharges the progress that women make. So, for example, Nancy Pelosi, when she was, and just remains, the leader of the Democrats in the House, she's almost single-handedly increased female participation in the Democratic caucus in the House from 19% to 37%, because she's emphasized the importance of electing women and bringing women in. Again, when you look back at the Senate, having executive actors in the Senate have really helped make progress. So the reason why critical mass is somewhere between 20 and 30% is because when you have executive actors, when you have people who are powerful, you don't need as many, right? So women sat atop, or chaired or ranked, ranking is the top, you know, party in the minority. They ranked or chaired on 11 of the 20 committees. So they were incredibly powerful. They only needed 20 of them to reach critical mass, right? But if you don't have those sort of critical actors, then you need a lot more sheer numbers, and that's why you need more than 30%. But to get back to the idea of women as that sort of capability test, right? So I covered both Hillary Clinton's campaigns for Time. I covered her campaign in 07, 08, and again in 16. And you could really see that. The first campaign she ran, she had to prove she was capable enough, right? She never really talked about being a female candidate. She didn't really bring up, you know, the historic nature of her candidacy. And she tried to, you know, she campaigned with lots of generals, with Wes Clark and with, like, authority figures, because she was, you know, she could take the call at 3 a.m. And she was, and her campaign slogan was, ready from day one, right? By the time we got to 2016, she actually had proven that she was capable enough. Polls showed that everybody thought Hillary Clinton was capable enough. The problem was she wasn't likable anymore because she'd crossed that line to becoming a bitch. And I'm going to set this aside. Hillary had a lot of other baggage, and that was not the only reason she lost the election. She herself had said that she was a terrible candidate. There's a lot of Clinton stuff out there. But this is a standard that applies to almost any woman running for executive office, and it's something to think about. So she had to prove that she was likable enough. And how did she do that? Well, she emphasized the historic nature of her campaign. She talked about being a grandma. She talked about, you know, how much progress she would make for women. And she tried to make herself very likable. And that's really tough when you're running for executive office. So when you think about women who are elected to executive office successfully in the history, they're all incredibly pragmatic women, right? So Angela Merkel, Margaret Thatcher, Theresa May, Dilma Rousseff, these are all world leaders who don't rhetorically soar. They're considered incredibly pragmatic, and they're usually elected in order to get the country through a tough time. Look at Theresa May, right? Brexit, we're going to elect a woman. And this happens in the private sector as well. Most female CEOs are appointed at a time when companies are really struggling. And that's because they're perceived as, A, being much harder to attack. So you saw, for example, Mary Barra. When she was appointed the head of GM, she went on the Today Show, and Matt Lauer said to her, well, isn't it true that you were just appointed because you're a woman and you're harder to attack? And she was like, no, I'm actually an electrical engineer, and I'm pretty qualified for the job. But you have this thing called, this sort of phenomenon called the glass cliff. And that means that when women CEOs are elected, they are easily shoved off the glass cliff when the company fails. And they're always put in this incredibly difficult position to either turn the company around really quickly and succeed, or they fail, like Marissa Mayer, and they get shoved off the glass cliff, and they're almost always replaced by white men. And so it is incredibly difficult for women to be inspirational in executive offices. So Barack Obama could talk about the arc of the moral universe bending towards justice every day, and everyone be like, wow, that's so inspiring. But women are not expected to inspire. And so I remember with Hillary, New Hampshire, the first time when we flew from Iowa to New Hampshire just after she'd barely won the Iowa caucus in 2016, we landed in New Hampshire. Nobody had slept. There was like an airport rally with hundreds of people there. And she gave this speech, and even I was like, man, that is so shrill. Like, she was really tired, and it was like she was screaming, and the audience was really loud, and everyone's kind of hair stood up in the back of their necks, and it was just like, oof. And right after that, Bob Woodward went on Morning Joe and said, she is so shrill, I can't even listen to her. She screams way too much. And that's, I have to say, really harsh and unfair for every woman in the world, because we are not a society, nobody has a society trained to listen to women raising their voice in passion. It's just impossible. Every time a woman raises her voice in passion, she's considered screaming. Why is mom yelling at me? She's so shrill. And it's really hard to show passion. Like, Bernie Sanders can yell at you for 40 minutes, and you're like, yeah, yell at me for 40 more, you know? And but Hillary is like, you know, you're like, oh my gosh, this is awful. Mom's yelling at me. I'm in trouble. So it's going to take generations of women raising their voice in passion in order to get to the point where we can feel comfortable to hear women yelling with passion about what they feel strongly about, unfortunately. And Hillary, right after that, in response, tried this weird whispering thing where she was like, I'm going to show passion by like stage whispering. And she's like, we get really quiet and say, oh, it's just so important to me. This is so great. America is so important. And it was terrible, and that lasted less than a week. So this is hard. I mean, you know, electing women to executive office is really, really difficult. And I remember being in New Hampshire and asking a young woman at a Bernie rally, why are you going to vote for Bernie versus Hillary? And she had been to rallies for both, and she was really eloquent, actually. She was like, if you think of going to a political event like going on a first date, Bernie sweeps you off your feet. It's all like, revolution, I'm going to change the world, and like free healthcare, and it's awesome. And you leave inspired. And she was like, and if you go to a Hillary event, you know it's really important, but it's like going on a first date with an actuary. And, you know, it's like, got to save for college, got to pay off your mortgage, got to do all these things that are like really important, but they're really boring, right? And so, and that's really hard. It's really hard to be inspirational and to soar and to yell and all these things that women really can't do. And I'm not saying that this is why Hillary lost the election. I'm just saying these are all factors. But all is not lost, so don't worry. there is the propensity to think this is terrible, women are not making any progress, we're screwed, essentially. And I want to like end on a positive note, and then I want to take your questions, because I love questions. And that is, when I was writing the book, I really worried about, I really didn't believe that I would ever see critical mass or parity, especially parity in my lifetime. And I'd always thought of parity as this like far off thing that's like kind of in the woods, never going to happen. But women actually were brought into the workforce because of economic necessity. So Rosie the Riveters during World War II, we would not have won the war if women hadn't been around to bring in the crops and build the planes and boats and do all these things. And by the way, we had universal childcare back then, because who else was going to take care of the kids, right? So, but it wasn't until the 1970s that all of the state laws banning married women from working without their husband's permission were fully repealed. And it will be economic necessity that brings women fully into the workforce. And we're actually not far away from that, which I think is really cool. And I'm really glad to be living in this time, because we'll get to see it. So by the year 2030, the baby boomer generation will have fully aged out of the workforce. And America will actually be short 26 million workers. There's only two ways to solve that shortfall. One, you bring in a ton new immigration, which is kind of hard to imagine with this administration. Or two, you bring women up to full employment in the workforce. That solves the hole by 23 million workers. Women already have the talents to do this. They make up more than half of college degrees. They make up more than 60% of graduate degrees. They're just not using them. This is not going to happen naturally. It's something that's going to have to be incentivized. We're going to have to talk about childcare. We're going to have to talk about, you know, how you get women sort of freed enough to take on bigger jobs. And part of that comes from men helping. So, and I think the next generation is really interesting, millennials, right? So I'm a cusp millennial, although I consider myself more Gen X. And I would say that the interesting thing about the millennial generation is that they are the first generation born assuming equality of the sexes. They're the first generation born to working women. It's one of the hallmarks of their generations. And so they actually have a lot more equality than other generations. So for example, right now, 30% of first contacts for kindergartners in America are men. That number rises to 50% in Silicon Valley, where a lot of men are changing the workforce by demanding more flexible time to go to their kids' soccer games, more flexible time to work from home so that they can actually take care of their kids, and they want to be involved in their children's lives. And that is beginning to change our workforce in really interesting ways. So we're going to have to continue that trend and build on it in order to get more women into the workforce down the road. And I'm just going to leave it at that and take your questions.
Thank you so much for talking. It's just great to hear other women trying. And so my question is kind of, how do you, at a personal level, besides obviously writing the book, which is great, feel like you can help inspire, be inspiring, have that passionate voice?
That's an interesting question. I've never been asked that before. I guess talking to you guys, partly. The book actually did very well during the campaign. I was the only interview that Hillary did, the only print interview that she did for the first 9 months of her campaign. And then I actually, ironically, I have a chapter about Republicans. And the main character in that chapter was someone named Kellyanne Conway. And so that got a resurgence of interest when Kellyanne became Donald Trump's campaign manager. And then I thought with the election, the book would die. And it's actually been really interesting that we just did a third reprint because there's been so much interest from women running for office, right? So there's more than 20,000 women right now running for office. And I've spent a fair amount of time like talking, you know, to women who are interested in running for office, I'm on the board of a group called Running Start, which helps encourage women to run for office. And there's just a lot of a lot of trainings and a lot of things going on right now, and that's the way I've been trying to give back and trying to help inspire more women and tell them it's great to run and you should run. And it's, you know, it's really hard to get women to run for office. There's an old adage that says that it takes seven times. You have to ask women seven times to run for office. Men, it's like, you're like, hey, do you wanna? And they're like, yeah. You don't even know what you're asking them for. They're like, I'll totally do it, you know? Women are, it's interesting because they feel very nervous about putting themselves forward that way. They, when you look at Emily's List, which is a big group on the Democratic side, they have these massive briefing books that, because every woman, before they decide they want to run for office, has to read every position on every question and every issue that they've ever might even consider voting for before they begin to think about running for office because they just want to be prepared. Men never do that. Like, like they know, like they're like, I'll figure it out when I get to the vote, right? Like, and so it's they think so heavily about that decision. It's like a really long process, and so and that's something that just takes a lot of time and a lot of like encouragement in order to get them to do it. And so I think that's partly what I've been doing to help give back, and I encourage other women to consider running, please. Like, I consider me one of the first of the seven asks. Run for office.
Hi. Thank you again, too. This is great. My question is about the Google anti-diversity memo that came out. I don't know how many people are familiar with it. My question is, what would you say to that author who has research backing up how women and minorities are not as capable of exceeding in these areas?
I would say Larry Summers said the same thing in 2005, and that got him fired from Harvard. So, when you say that women are not as good engineers and they're not as good at mathematics or other things, I mean, that's obviously ridiculous. I would also say that it's not a level playing field, right? And so it's sort of like everybody who talks about, well, minorities, you know, don't like get all these advantages, and therefore, that's unfair. But again, it's not a level playing field when you're looking at low-income, you know, statuses. And so, women have a lot, have struggled a lot to, break into STEM. And the irony is that 20, 30 years ago, you look at that movie Hidden Figures that just came out, 20, 30 years ago, 40, 50 years ago, women actually had stronger presences in STEM. And women actually had the natural inclination. They were the human computers, right? Like, those were mostly women jobs, women held jobs, and because they were better at math, frankly, than men were. And so if you looked at like the rates of graduation from mathematics and from engineering, women had a lot higher rates back then than they do now. And so we've lost that in many ways because the society has said to women, it's not cool, it's not sexy, it's not like, you're never going to find a husband if you are like a math geek, essentially. And so, that's something that people are trying to fix. There's like groups called Goldilocks, which build like sort of toys for young girls that like are math and science based. There's groups, that have lobbied the hell out of Barbie to turn her into something human. And there's all kinds of movements to try to change the way girls are mentored and the way that their aspirations are, right? And so that it becomes cooler to be a math geek and to be, and to be into science, and it becomes okay. But our societal sort of pressures as it stands right now really move against that, and that's something that we really have to change.
Very inspirational. Thank you so much. What do you think we need to do as women, and probably also for men, to be taken seriously? Because a lot of times we're in meeting rooms and, you've got a mix of women and men, and women are talking and they get snubbed or their opinion just doesn't count. What do you think needs to change on both sides?
My first chapter looks at women in the West Wing. And in Obama's White House, you had 39% women in the first term in the West Wing. And so they had the numbers for critical mass. But very famously, by November of 2009, they were all so miserable. They had this dinner in the residence with the president where they were basically like, this is not working. Like, Larry Summers yells over us. We never, Rahm Emanuel just yells at everybody, Peter Orszag is a jerk. I mean, they were not breaking through and they weren't really working. And they were like, you need to do something to help us. And Obama, interestingly enough, was pretty unsympathetic. And he was like, the guys are doing what I need them to do. I need you to step up. And he was like, you have the numbers, start being each other's allies. He's like, because that's what the men do. They're each other's allies. He was like, you got to work together. And so they were like, you know, almost offhandedly, he was like, why don't you start having dinner like once a month or whatever? And they did actually start doing that. And they, you know, a lot of the women had come from different areas, some from New York, some from Chicago, some from D.C. They didn't really know each other that well, and they began to get to know each other. And then once they got to know each other and they became friends, and really, like, a lot of these dinners involved things that had conversations that had nothing to do with the West Bank. And it had to do with, like, their kids and life balance and, like, you know, the best place to get your hair done. I mean, it was, like, really simple stuff, right? But they became each other's allies. And so, for example, the president's personal secretary, Julie Brown, whenever she would see guys going in for a meeting with the president, she would text other women and be like, hey, Larry just went in for a meeting, you should come down, you know, and like when women were in a meeting that was, you know, let's say about foreign policy, but then turned to economics, they would email each other and say, hey, this is what happened in this meeting, you should be up to date and you should check in with X, Y, and Z that this happened because the guys were talking about it in front of me. And they developed strategies to help women really listen to each other. And so, for example, if you're, and this has happened to every woman in the room, where you're in a meeting and you say something, everyone's like, uh-huh, and then like 10 minutes later, a guy says the exact same thing, and everyone's like, oh my God, that's genius. And you're like, I just said that. and so they would back each other up. And so, you know, if a woman made a point that nobody really paid attention to, and then a man made that point, then another woman would say, hey, but that was a great point when Julie made it 10 minutes ago, too, right? Like, and not in like mean ways, but they would sort of back each other up. They helped each other, like kind of train each other. So Carol Browner always told this, she's the EPA czar, she always told this great story about how she was watching a woman in the, they were doing Cafe Standard talks, and there was a woman who was brilliantly leading a meeting. Everyone was so impressed with her. Then they needed copies of something. And she was like, and she leaped up, because we're women and we want to like help and we want to like smooth the process and you can probably do it quicker than anybody else. Leaped up and ran to make copies, came back, and by the time she came back, every man in the room had discounted her as a secretary. Completely lost control of the meeting. So Carol would always say to the women, don't do menial things. If, like, it's not your job to do it. Like, there's 10,000 interns for you to do that you can hand it off to. Like, don't feel like you have to do those things. I mean, so they would give each other advice like that. And it actually really helped. And so by the end of it, the end of the chapter is one of my favorite stories, where during the 2010 grand bargain negotiations, there were three women who felt really just frustrated because they kept getting left out of the talks, right? So there was two deputy chiefs of staff who were both women, Nancy Andaparl, who was deputy chief of staff for policy, and Alyssa Mastromonaco, who was deputy chief of staff for scheduling and planning. And so Alyssa controlled the budget, so you couldn't actually do a debt ceiling negotiation or a grand bargain without her signing it off, because she had the budget. Nancy Ann controlled all policy, and then Stephanie Cutter controlled all communications. And so these are three really pivotal things you need to like make any deal. And yet they kept getting left out of meetings. And so one Sunday, they heard from Julie that that Larry Summers and David Plouffe had gone to the president's office to talk about the debt ceiling or talk about the grand bargain negotiations, and they're like, got really pissed off they'd been left out yet again. So they gathered in front of the Oval and they were like, okay, what are we gonna do here? And they just walked in uninvited. And they just sat down and started taking part in the meeting. And the president was like, hey, guys. And they were like, hey. And like, and the men got the message. And they never did it again. And so they were just like, look, you know, if you're going to have these things without us, we're just going to barge in. And so by the time the second term came around, that White House was ruled by women. So it was like all women. So, yep. Any other questions? Yeah.
It's really interesting. Some of the things that you talked about have really hit me in a way that it's like, oh, there's the hope that I've been looking for. You know, I'm a very vocal person and try and point out different things about, hey, you know, we need to step up this way and all of that. But the grind of it and the slow pace of change really gets to you. Mm-hmm. But you brought up the idea of critical mass and the progress that is being made, and also the boomers leaving the workforce, creating a, you know, this economic need. I'm like, holy crap! All this every effort is going to multiply into something. And so but I've never heard that before in all the stuff I've read. I've never heard it before. And so I'm wondering what we can do to amplify kind of that message of, hey, we are making progress, and the concept of critical mass and all of that, getting that more into the regular conversation.
Yeah, it is frustrating. And part of the reason why when I wrote my book, I really wanted to make it optimistic. I wanted to, like, you know, and some women were critical of me and said, like, you know, you didn't focus enough on the doom and gloom. And I was like, man, I've read 10,000 women's books that were all doom and gloom. Like, I wanted something that could gather together what progress we've made and actually, like, talk about and celebrate the progress that we've made and the difference that we're making. I think that you can feel the conversation shifting in many ways, right? So as women are reaching critical mass in different areas of the workforce, their voices are becoming much more amplified and much more heard. So like Hollywood, for example, 26% of film producers are now women, which is critical mass. And you see, like, all of a sudden, Hollywood is like, all they can talk about is like women, right? Like, it's become like, you know, Patricia Arquette and Jennifer Lawrence demanding equal pay. You know, like, there's 1,500 directors, female directors, suing the Directors Guild with the ACLU because they were unjustly kept out of the Directors Guild. So there's all this discussion and movement towards bringing more women into that workforce. And like Gina Davis actually has a great institute. I think it's like the Institute of Arts or something for Women in the Arts that does nothing but lobby Hollywood, like, producers and Hollywood, I guess, what are they called, movie production companies, to, if you're going to have, like, an androgynous C-form that's shaped like a sponge, why does it have to be a man, right? Like, can it not be a woman? Like, you know, like, if you're going to have lots of extras in the set, why do they have to all be men? Like, let's make it equally balanced and have women and men, you know? I mean, it's, like, really basic stuff. If you're going to have a voiceover of, like, a sea squid, let's make it a woman, right? Like, or whatever it is. And so... And she has some great numbers, and they've been really doing a lot to, like, lobby things. Jennifer, what's her name? She's the wife of the lieutenant governor who's running for governor. But she has this whole series of movies called Misrepresentation, where she talks about, on the red carpet, can we actually ask women to, like, what they're there for, to what they're being celebrated for, what is their artistic achievement, rather than what they're wearing and who they're dating? Like, maybe that might be nice. There's a lot of, you know, you're beginning, like, pop music, I think, is a great example, right? So 60 years ago, women were not allowed to be in music, in popular music, because it was considered unseemly for them to sing in public on a stage, right? Now it's, like, dominated by women. There's, like, two guys named Justin, and everybody else is women, right? Like, and so, and it's, so you see, like, these conversations. Ariana Grande was, like, you know, just recently said she's never going to disclose ever again who she's dating because she doesn't want to be defined by the guy that she's dating. She should be defined by her music. So I think that there's, as each of these areas of the workforce reaches critical mass, you can see the conversations change and women begin to become much more active and then begin to change. I mean, there are places, obviously, where we're really far away from it, but even in those places, like Silicon Valley, the Google memo, right? Like, these are still topics where people are very engaged and very aware that this is happening. And so I can only be hopeful that, like, you know, that we'll be able to do this. One of the... just on a, like, a really local level, one of the groups that I worked with and is called Generation W, and they developed a scorecard. If you go on their website, you can find it. And so one of the big challenges for women is just data, right? Like, and I was naively assumed that, like, oh, there must be lots of data about women in the workforce, right, when I started writing this book. I went to, like, the Department of Labor. I was like, what do you have? There's a whole women's bureau. And they were like, well, we can tell you that in 1989, IBM had 17% women. And I was like, that's so not helpful. Like, what? Like, and they're like, well, all of the reporting is done voluntarily, so we only have people volunteer to report, and which is not that much. And so I was like, well, that's useless. To figure out that there are 30% women in the administration, I had to go to all 13 departments of the government for labor unions in the White House, because nobody collects those statistics, amazingly. Like, literally, the government cannot tell you how many women they have in executive-level offices that, you know, at all. I mean, like, across the board. It's just stunning to me. So nobody collects this data. It's sort of amazing, right? Like, in the workforce, when you have data that's on, like let's say, McKinsey can tell you that that 16% of traders in the banking industry are women. How do they know that? Because they've polled the banking industry. Now, the banking industry only discloses that information to McKinsey on the with the idea that, like, the numbers, well, the raw data of bank by bank will never be made public. So they can only report these numbers in aggregate, never and like in detail. So we don't know how many women are in any of these companies, actually, right? Like, there's no way of finding that out. And so if we don't know where we are, it's very hard to know how to get where we're going, right? And so just sheer, like, reporting of numbers is so helpful. So they developed, like, you know, another example. Sorry, I'm going to go off on this a little bit, but, like, another example is women in law enforcement, right? Like, if there was ever a time to have more women in law enforcement, it's now, right? Like, in the time of Ferguson and riots in Baltimore and, like, all this violence, women almost never used violence as a first solution. They never, like, there was an amazing study in Houston where Anise Parker, who is the mayor, studied use of tasers in the first 2 years they were rolled out in the police force. Not a single woman had used her taser in that 2 years, not a single female officer. Women used the same amount of regular force, that acceptable regular force, but they almost never use excessive force. And 98% of cases of excessive force, of lawsuits against police in America, are against men. There's no, the last sort of group that tracks women in the police force went defunct like 3 years ago. So there's no one actually tracking how many women are in police forces. There's every effort is just sort of city by city, and it's very ad hoc. No one really knows how many women are in police forces. We think there's about 14% to 17%, but we're not sure. And so there's just no one, there's very few efforts. There's no national effort to bring more women into policing. There's nothing. I mean, it's just really a dearth, and it's kind of terrible. So if you just, like, what Gen W did is they just created the scorecard where they're like, go around and ask people in your local areas, how many women do you have in your police force? How many women do you have in your city council? How many women do you have, like, you know, on, like, local boards and local for local big companies that are driving the economy? And just start to collect this information, because nobody is. We don't have it. So, and that's the first step. So Lorraine Powell Jobs and Melissa Gates both in the last year started data building initiatives to track more women, more data on women, just because there's just so little. And we don't know. And until we know that, we're not going to be able to really build on it. Anyone else got questions?
Hi. So I'm a Gen X female in the Canadian government, and a lot of what you're talking about resonates. And the conversations I've been having with a lot of my peers over the last few years, especially as we're all, like, heading over, you know, we're over 40 and we're heading towards 50 now, is as a Gen X female in government, and most of us are practitioners, we don't want to be execs yet, our kids are, you know, just going into high school or whatever, we're really ignored, right? So it's run by a bunch of boomers who think that good ideas can only come from Gen Y. Mm-hmm. And so we're sitting at this layer where there's a ton of buzzwords going around, and it doesn't matter that we have, you know, 20, 25 years experience, that we've been doing this stuff forever, that we've seen the cycles and know that's not a new idea just because it's new to you. And we're really challenged, right? So if I don't want to become an exec until my kids graduated from high school, and I plan to be really awesome at what I do because I've been doing it for so long, but I'm shouting into the darkness, you know, that I find is a really weird place to be. And that hope thing that Gail was talking about is really hard to cling to and think, I want to be here for a while. I want to do really good things. But I really feel like nobody's paying any attention. So I, you know, I can do really well on the stuff that I'm working on, but in order to have any level of impact, right, in order to be able to help push things forward, we really feel like we're shouting into the darkness. And it's a feeling that I've found from a lot of Gen X females that I've worked with. Did you encounter anything like that in your research?
Yeah, so women need, so Harvard and Catalyst, which is a great group that tracks women in the executive workforce out of New York, and they have a lot of awesome research on their website, but Harvard and Business School and Catalyst did a study where they tracked one class of Harvard Business School graduates. And they found that there'd been this stereotype that women weren't putting themselves out as aggressively as men were. And in fact, they found that women were putting themselves out as aggressively as men were. But the difference was is that men had validators behind them. So men would be like, hey, I'm great for this job. You should promote me. And then standing behind him would be like three mentors who'd be like, yeah, that kid is so awesome. You should definitely hire him. You should definitely use him. He's really great. And so they had this echo chamber of validators who like were all, you know, promoted them. Women lacked validators. And so they would be like, I'm really awesome. You should promote me for this job. And they were seen, but there's no one else standing behind them. And they were seen as overly aggressive. Like asking the same thing as the men were, they were like, oh, she's so aggressive. She's like too aggressive, you know? And so like they didn't advance as much as the men did because they, when they tried to advance, they were perceived as not, you know, wrong for the job or too aggressive or just not the way people perceive women. And so what the study basically found is that you need mentors. You need like, and they can be male. That's great. In fact, awesome. We need to involve men in this process, right? There's like this very effective program in Australia called the Male Champions for Change, which is kind of a funny name, but like it actually is true because you're not going to, the 5% of female CEOs in America are not going to be responsible for bringing, you know, millions of women into the workforce, right? You have to engage the men. And what Australia did is they reached this demographic cliff that we're going to face. A lot sooner than we did. And so they were like, well, shit, we don't know what to do. Do we bring in like more immigrants? That's not something we really want to do. How are we going to like fix this massive gap in our workforce? And what they did is they created the Male Champions for Change. They challenged every major CEO in the country to not only transparently state how many women they had in their workforce, but also how many women they were training, retaining when they came back from childbirth. And promoting, and then they set goals and then basically said, you know, if we don't reach those goals, we're going to shame you. They have this like lunch annually, and they put out this report, and the ones that don't get it actually seriously get shamed. In Australia, it's a big deal. And it's been incredibly effective. I mean, like, you know, they've almost doubled all of their numbers in like the last 7 years that it's been going. And so like, you know, women on corporate boards went from something like 17% to like almost 40% now. Women in mining, for Christ's sake, women in mining have more than doubled. So almost a quarter of all miners in Australia are women now, which is kind of amazing. But they found, like this study with Harvard and Catalyst, that they needed the men, the male CEOs, the male board members, to step up and say, I'm going to champion this woman, I'm going to mentor this woman, I'm going to bring her along I'm going to be champions for them, because otherwise it wasn't going to work. So I would say, find yourself a bunch of male mentors who will be your cheerleaders and who will help you, like, move along in advance.
Just so you know, I was a 32-year veteran of CIA, and I was a senior leader there. Huh? And I wanted to share this story, kind of follow on with what you said. So I think it's very important for women in the workforce not to let the system get by using adjectives to describe them. So I had a case where when I was a senior leader, I chaired the promotion board into the senior executive ranks. Mm-hmm. And there was this woman, excellent person, who, when it came time to consider her, the 15 people around the table, they all had a story about how she had, quote unquote, sharp elbows. So what I said was, luckily it was the end of the day, and I said, you know, I don't like this phrase, sharp elbows. I don't know what it means. So it's the end of the day. I want you to go back. And I want you to come back tomorrow with a specific instance, a story about her performance that captures what you think her issue is. So what do you think happened the next day?
No examples.
No one had a story, and she was promoted. So I think it's very important to, and I think, you know, all of us that are on promotion boards have to stop letting people get away with adjectives, which are just horrible. That's my comment.
So there's a guy in the UK who's a language expert. There's a whole word for that I can't remember what it is, but anyway, lexicologist or something like that. I don't know. He found that there's 150 negative words for women for every one negative word for a man. So it's sort of stunning. Like, you know, even my book, Broad Influence, right? So the word broad used to be a pejorative word that was actually started in the 1800s in the Dickensian times. And it was meant to describe women because they had broad hips because they have kids, right? And so, oh, she's broad, abroad. And like, and so it was so offensive to women that they actually lobbied the Olympic committees in the 1930s or actually 1960s to change the broad jump to the long jump because it was just an offensive term. But I think the idea of reclaiming these terms, it's not just me with broad influence, but broad city, there's like, you know, broadly, which is the Vice sort of blog for women. There's the idea of trying to reclaim some of these words, I think, is really important because we just don't, we have like literally no terms left to describe ourselves that aren't negative. Like I, at some point I got into a lot of trouble with women who were writing that, you know, I use the word female in my book a lot. So it's like female engineers, female politicians, right? And it's like, because it's actually grammatically incorrect to say women politicians, because women is not an adjective, right? Like women is a noun. So I use the word female and I interchange it a lot. And so, and the people were like, but female is actually a pejorative word right now. And I like ended up writing a column for Time where I was like, seriously? Like, if we have no words left to describe ourselves, like, what are we supposed to use? I mean, like, there's just nothing left. So it's really, really frustrating. But it is, you're right, we need to find terms and find better ways. I guess the last, I think we're almost out of time, right? But the last note I would leave you with is there's a great book by Annès Bonnet, and this actually speaks to the Google thing as well, called What Works. She's the head of women's programs at Harvard. And her first chapter looks at, and it's basically what works to get women into the workforce. It's a whole book about like these ways in which you can help bring women in. And the first chapter looks at the Boston Symphony. And about a decade ago, they realized that they had very few women. And they were like, how do we fix this? And so they actually started blind auditions. So the musicians would audition behind a curtain. And they would take off their shoes so you couldn't even hear like on the stage who's coming in. And they would just play music. And very quickly, within 5 years, they were 50-50. Like, right? Because women, and that was because people were biased against the women, you know, musicians versus the male musicians. Same thing with, like, UPenn did a bunch of studies looking at CEO Jane and CEO Jack, right? And CEO Jane and CEO Jack do exactly the same things, but everyone's like, oh man, CEO Jane's way too aggressive. You know, like, CEO Jack's perfect. He's, like, really awesome. So just being aware of these inherent biases that exist in our language, in our imagery, in, you know, in the way that we're raised, in the way that we talk to each other, I think is really important. And that's the first step, really, to changing things. So I'll leave you with that. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Chicago Camps 2017 Prototypes, Process, and Play Design Leadership Conference podcast, sponsored by Balsamiq. With Balsamiq mockups, anyone can design great interfaces. And in partnership with Simplecast, publish your podcasts the easy way at simplecast.fm. Learn more about Chicago Camps events on our website at chicagocamps.org.